This is the Skeptic Squared Podcast.
A safe place to make light of sacred things.
My name is Matt.
And I'm Corinne.
And in this program, we will be discussing current events related to religion, atheism, and skepticism. Our goal is not to insult believers,
although that will probably happen from time to time,
but rather to share our point of view on these topics in a way which will benefit and entertain others.
Or maybe we just want to stroke our own egos. You decide.
Welcome to the Skeptic Squared Podcast. Today is Sunday, August 14th, 2016. And with me is my wife, Corinne.
Hello.
How are you?
Fine.
Fine.
As my voice cracks.
You okay?
Yeah.
Need some water?
Nope.
Okay. So yesterday we went to another mass resignation in Salt Lake City for the Mormon Church. But before we get to talking about our experience with that and how it compares to the other mass resignation that we went to in November. I actually have an update to something that we talked about a few episodes ago. I can't remember exactly when we talked about it, but it was, so the original thing that we talked about was about the state of Utah declaring pornography to be a public health crisis. Okay. And in response to that, the CEO of the magazine Hustler said that he was going to start sending copies of their pornographic magazine to the leaders of the Utah government that made this happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't entirely clear if he was going to send them to LDS church leaders as well. But apparently he's not the only one. Penthouse magazine, another pornographic magazine, also did the same thing. So, but here's the update. So, when news of this came out, a guy by the name of Jared decided that he was going to send various church publications to Penthouse in response. And so I posted this like little meme thing that was posted from a Mormon Facebook page called Awaken to Our Awful Situation, which is a phrase from the Book of Mormon about how depraved humans are and how we're all screwed unless we accept Mormonism.
Thank you, God.
Yep. But remember, Mormons don't believe in original sin. We just, you know, automatically sin.
You know? Right.
Anyway. So that's the update that I have for that. Like, he's just sending stuff in response. But something that I found that on that same page, Awaken to Our Awful Situation, they just love doing memes, okay? But I noticed this one particular picture. It was the name of the church in Russian.
Okay.
So I served my mission in Bulgaria, which is, the language is very similar to Russian, so I caught my eye.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and I read the little placard thing. It was just the church's name. But it came with a neat little quote from a guy named Elder John A. Widso.
Oh, okay.
Who, from what I remember, was an apostle. And this quote is from 1932 when he was speaking in Prague while it was still Czechoslovakia. So this is like pre-World War II, pre-Cold War, and communism was like starting to become a really big thing in Russia, and they were starting to pick up the smaller countries in Eastern Europe, right? And part of that meant that there wouldn't be any religion, no proselytizing at least, in those countries, okay? So it was kind of a point of concern for Mormons who think that they're going to flood the earth with the Book of Mormon before the Second Coming, because the Second Coming can't happen until everybody, at least every country, has Mormon missionaries.
Right.
Yeah. So I'll just read the quote. Again, this is an apostle from 1932 in the Mormon Church. Communism is the work of the devil. The Lord is using it to break down the hold of the Catholic and Russian Orthodox churches over the minds of men. So just wrap your head around that first. Okay. So first he says it is the work of the devil, communism. And then he says that the Lord is using communism, the work of the devil, to break the hold of the Catholic Church and Russian Orthodox Church. And then he explains how or why he's doing this. So when communism has completed its task of breaking its hold, it will pass out of existence almost overnight. Okay. So think about that. So when the when communism ended in Russia, did that make all of communism end overnight?
No.
No. Not even close.
No.
No. Okay. And then the church will send missionaries by the hundreds into the Slavic lands of Europe, including the motherland of Russia. There is more of the blood of Israel in Western Russia than all the rest of Europe put together. Okay, so that's one of the reasons why Mormons think this is so important, because they're all about bringing the lost tribes of Israel together so they can all become Mormon together. And that plays into the whole Second Coming thing. Right.
Right.
Let's see. And when the time comes to do missionary work there, the people will come into the church by the thousands. Whole villages and towns will join the church in groups. This mission is important because it is opening the door to the Slavic nations. This language is the key to all Slavic languages. I assume he's talking about Russian. And some of you in this room will be called to do missionary work in Russia.
When did Russia open up?
Early 90s, I think. Like around 1990.
Oh, okay.
So the wall came down in, 89, right? And it took a couple of years for the church to be able to send missionaries there. But I think it was like between 90 and 92
okay.
when they started sending missionaries out, which is the same time that my mission, Bulgaria, opened up.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, they were communist as well.
Right.
And I can tell you, there are not whole villages and towns joining the Mormon church.
Right.
There just aren't. They actually despise Mormons quite a bit.
Right.
They look at them as, they call them sects. But they say it in, like, this very derogatory term. What they mean is not a splinter group. They mean a cult.
Right.
When they say it.
Right.
And they use the same kind of tone and the same term to describe Jehovah's Witnesses and Seventh-day Adventists, who are also big proselytizers in that region.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I can't even tell you how many times I got onto a bus dressed as a missionary, Mormon missionary, right? With the shirt and tie and the little placard and all that. And just, you know, nice little old lady just looking right at us and going, ah, secta, secta! And then going to the end of the bus and just so she can avoid us.
Oh, my gosh.
Because and this is something that Elder Widso didn't count on, Orthodoxy, Russian Orthodoxy, and you know, the various forms, like Bulgarians have their own form of it, which is very similar. It's part of their culture.
Right.
It helped them, at least for Bulgaria, it helped them keep their identity throughout the Ottoman Empire. So when the Turks, who share a border with Bulgaria, came in through Bulgaria to take over the whole of Europe, which they got pretty close to doing, they tried to make Bulgarians Muslim, okay? And part of the way that they resisted that was by keeping their Bulgarian Orthodox heritage, okay? So when the communists came in and said, you can't go to church and you can't do this and you can't do that, that didn't stop them from believing. Like, they kept the tradition. They just kept it in their home.
Okay.
They just couldn't do, like, the public displays thing. But all of the old churches, still up.
Still there.
They're
right.
Still there, you know. And the Bulgarian Orthodox Church, I imagine, is similar to the Russian Orthodox Church in that it has a huge hold on the, popular culture and attitudes of, just people in general in the country. It's by far the largest religion in Bulgaria. And I'm pretty sure it's the same for the Russian Orthodox Church. So this whole idea that communism, the purpose of communism, despite being a product of the devil, right, is going to break Russian Orthodoxy and Catholicism so that the Mormon Church can explode, is just ridiculous. And it's patently absurd, you know. But they add at the end of this quote, this is, again, from the Mormon group that posted this, they say, some have called this a prophecy. Whatever you call it, portions of it have come true already, and I'm positive other parts will too. It was recorded by several individuals, including the then local mission president, it has been reproduced in books by the likes of W. Cleon Skousen, which is a big name in Mormon apologetics. He's a church historian, basically. Anyway, I just thought that was interesting. It would give us a good segue into what we went through yesterday in going to the mass resignation, because after going to the resignation, which we'll talk about, we decided, for some reason,
to go to the Beehive House.
To go to the Beehive House, which is like right across the street, and take a tour, a 15-minute tour, with two Mormon missionaries.
Sister missionaries.
And so we'll get into that. But, yeah, so a lot of the stuff that I have to talk about has to do with missionary work, and I thought that was a good way to segue into it. So, mass resignation.
Right.
Let's start with how many people were there?
Not a lot.
Not a lot. It was probably around 100 or so, I think.
Yeah.
Kind of coming and going.
Yeah.
The one that we had in November was a couple of thousand.
Yes.
So it's a much smaller number. Yeah. But part of that, I think, has to do with the fact that at this resignation is a lawyer, Mark Noggle, I think is his name.
Something like that.
He offers his services to represent you in resigning from the LDS Church for free. Mm-hmm. And he actually has a website. I think it's quitmormon.com or something like that, where you can go and just resign on that website. He'll take care of all the legal documents and everything. All you have to do is sign for him to be your representative between you and the church. And then he takes care of it. It's all pro bono. And he was at the mass resignation yesterday. He was also there in November. Mm-hmm. And there have been a few posts on the ex-Mormon Reddit where he's talked about this, you know, this whole experience and how it just kind of, you know, ballooned after the policy change in November that happened. And how he's gone through several thousand resignations through his firm. So I think part of that is tapping into this whole mass resignation thing. So it's not so, I don't know, you know, you don't need to go to a mass resignation in order to resign.
No.
It's more about the solidarity and the community. And there were a few speakers there. There was Kate Kelly, who was the founder of the Ordained Women group. And she got excommunicated. So you can actually look her up and see her story. She has a few interesting things to say. She said that she was, she looked up to people who actually resigned from the church. She felt like being excommunicated is kind of a different situation. It takes a little bit more courage, or a different kind of courage, to officially resign before it gets to the point of excommunication. There was somebody else there that talked about, you know, the whole Mormon spectrum thing, like not trying to push how you should live your life after you leave the church. You know, like, you should be accepting of anybody that leaves the church. You shouldn't necessarily want to push everybody towards your particular church or atheism or something like that. You know.
Which one was that?
It was one of the, actually, that particular person was the lady, kind of one of the organizers who
the one that's running for office in Orem.
Maybe. I thought it was the other one.
With the short hair or the long hair?
I think it was with the shorter hair.
Yeah.
Anyway. But yeah, it's... But it, I don't know. It kind of reminded me a little bit of that that Mormon Stories podcast where they talk to the Mama Dragons.
Mm.
And how they kind of have that policy where you don't really talk about leaving the church, you know. And now this post-Mormon community is talking about how you shouldn't just talk about leaving religion in general. It's just about leaving Mormonism. And, you know, on some level, I understand where they're coming from. There is a spectrum. People are at different places within their spiritual journey and all that kind of stuff. I think it's kind of silly to put a limit on it, on talking about it. You know, or maybe it was just for that resignation.
I think it was just for that resignation. They didn't want people to get up and preach and say, this is what you should do now that you've resigned.
Yeah.
It needs to be an individual journey for each person.
Yeah.
I think that's what she was trying to get at, which I agree with.
Yeah. Anyway, any other impressions about the mass resignation? Any other thing you want to talk about?
No.
No. Okay. Yeah. It was still kind of nice to just get out and, you know, rub elbows with other post-Mormons, ex-Mormons, whatever. Okay. So one of the things that missionaries in the Mormon Church are taught is that they are called to do this extra special thing, right? And because they're called to do an extra special thing from God, they are going to be protected. And a lot of that protection comes from them following a long list of prohibitions. Okay. So they can't do any extreme sports. They can't go swimming or water ski. And they can't, you know, climb really big mountains, you know, all that kind of stuff. And as a result of this, there is actually a statistic that has been popping up now and again. Now and then, about how Mormon missionaries tend to not have as many fatal accidents as other people in their age group.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, makes complete sense because right. they're not really doing dangerous activities. Mm-hmm. But so with that comes this kind of culture within the Mormon Church that missionaries are a protected class, that God will do anything to save them and prevent them from any kind of harm. Okay. Well, on August 8th of this year, there was a missionary who was coming home from his mission. And
he was coming home?
Yeah. This is in Las Vegas.
Ugh.
So he's coming home to Las Vegas, which has a strong Mormon community there. Like, it's a pretty big population. Somewhat ironically, yeah. Although, to be fair, the Mormons were there before the casinos.
Yes.
So, anyway, so he gets home. He meets his family. And they start driving home.
Oh, my gosh.
And they crash their car. And three people died. The missionary, his father, and the brother-in-law, I think is who it was. Okay. So this is like...
Oh my gosh.
This is like
so
a stab in the heart. Like, he was literally on his way home.
Hadn't even been released yet.
Yeah, to be released from his mission. And this happens. You know, and I don't want to, like, you know, revel in the fact that this tragedy happened because it proves a point that I'm trying to make. It's right. still a tragedy.
Yeah.
You know, it's awful that it happened. But at the same time, it kind of sheds light on the fact that Mormons and the missionaries are just regular people. Like, there's nothing out there that's protecting them from
right.
everything that's trying to kill them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, they happen to not do as many dangerous activities. They don't smoke or drink. You know,
they have curfews.
They have curfews, you know. Like, yeah, like, they take a lot of precautions to uh-huh. keep themselves safe.
Right.
And that's what's protecting them.
Yeah.
It isn't God. It isn't something divine, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And this story, I think, reflects that, as terrible as it is. It's like the, you know, the argument, or what is it, the problem of evil. That people often bring up. They talk about how can there be a God? Because in the world, there are 5 million children under the age of 5 who die of starvation every year. So how could a God allow for that to happen?
Uh-huh.
You know, how can a God, what was the example that Stephen Fry used in that one interview? There's a parasite.
The fly?
Yeah, a parasite fly that lays eggs in the eyes of children whose sole purpose is to eat its way out through the eyes. You know, that's their entire life cycle, you know. And, like, what kind of God would allow that to be part of its creation? And Mormons and, well, not even so much Mormons, it's kind of more of an evangelical view. Well, they'll say it's because of the fall. We live in a fallen world, and Satan has a hold on certain aspects of humanity and of nature and that kind of stuff. But that, I think, is a ridiculous argument because God is omnipotent.
Yeah.
And Satan, however powerful you think he is not omnipotent, which means that he will always fail compared to God.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So anything that happens, anything that Satan ever does, is done with the allowance of God. God allows that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Why on earth would God allow that to happen? You know?
Right.
And there isn't a real good argument that I've heard, you know. It's just, you know, free will and agency and all that kind of stuff. It's like parasites have nothing to do with agency.
And there has to be opposition in all things.
Yeah, tornadoes have nothing to do with agency. Opposition in all, yeah, the Mormon phrase.
Yeah, you can't have good without bad.
Yeah.
Which, again, is silly because God should be omnipotent. Omnipotent.
Mm. Well, I mean, that brings in the argument that I think we've mentioned before. Is there free will in heaven?
Right.
Uh-huh. Because Mormons and everybody else say that heaven is going to be free of sin. It's not going to have all this bad stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So if it doesn't have all the bad stuff, you don't have opposition against all things, and you don't, or opposition in all things, and you don't have the things in nature that are going to be, you know, killing people and causing people to starve to death or have all of these diseases and things. You know, that's not going to happen in heaven. Mm-hmm. So if God can do it and still keep our free will intact in heaven,
Why can't he do it here?
Yeah.
Yeah. Someone did finally say that there isn't free agency in heaven. It might have been on a podcast. I can't remember now.
Mormons won't accept that.
I wish I could remember who that was. It might have been on Dogma Debate.
Maybe. I can't even tell you how many times. That sounds like a very Calvinist thing. Maybe it's a Calvinist thing. Because they don't really believe in free will anyway. Because they accept
the whole predestination and stuff.
Yeah, that thing.
Yeah.
So maybe that was it. But, I mean, I can't even tell you how many times I heard my own mother talk about how we're not to be robots. God doesn't want robots. That's why he's not going to give you a big miracle.
He just wants sheep.
Yeah, exactly. He doesn't want robots. He wants sheep. And the best sheep are robots. You know, but she's trying to make the point that, you know, that it's all about free will. He doesn't want people to just go through the motions. But that's exactly what's going to happen in heaven based on their own parameters that they've set.
Right.
You know, it's like you're not going to have opposition. You're not going to have sin. So how can you still have the same kind of free will that you think sin and opposition provide for in this life right now? You know, like how are you going to get that same kind of thing in heaven?
Uh-huh.
You know, without those things.
Right.
I don't know. It's a muddled mess. It's a big hole in the story.
Yeah.
And another thing, kind of tying into the same idea, there was an article from Hemant Mehta, the friendly atheist. He talks about how the Jehovah's Witnesses recently got in trouble. Again, Jehovah's Witnesses like to do the whole missionary bit, similar to the Mormons. And they had a guy going door to door, trying to convert people to Jehovah's Witnesses, Witnessism? What is that? Jehovah's Witnessing?
I think it's just Jehovah Witness. I don't know that it's plural.
Okay. And it turns out that this man is a sex offender. So they had this guy going door to door.
And they knew that he was
that he was a sex offender. Oh. And they had him going around. He was a pedophile, child molester. And so they got into big trouble when this became known that this guy was a sex offender. But that brings up an interesting point. Like, people always assume that these missionaries are, you know, good people. They're trying to just, you know, spread the good news of their church and that kind of thing. But you don't have any idea who these people are.
No.
It could be a pedophile like this man was. It could be somebody who's not even a Jehovah's Witness or a Mormon missionary. It could just be a con artist. That happened. I can't remember the details of it, but I remember hearing about an incident where a couple of guys dressed up as Mormon missionaries and used it as a ruse to get into people's homes and then rob them blind. You know, they were breaking and entering artists.
It's kind of smart.
It's genius in a way.
Yeah.
You know, but why do we give this kind of implicit trust to people that are dressed up nice talking about religion? You know, you don't know who they are, you know.
It's because of the stigma that follows being religious.
Yeah.
A religious person would never do those things.
Yeah, because no religious people ever get sent to prison.
Right.
One last thing that I want to talk about with the whole missionary thing before we move on to your stuff.
Are we going to talk about the Beehive House?
Oh, that's right. We haven't talked about
that. No, you just moved right into that, so I thought you were segueing again.
Yeah, that's not what I was doing. I was segueing.
I mean, we can finish with your article and then do the Beehive House and then move into mine.
No, I have a feeling that this one might take a little bit longer.
Okay.
Anyway, or not, but let's just talk about the Beehive House. So the Beehive House is a house that was owned by Brigham Young, who was the second president of the Mormon Church.
Yes.
After Joseph Smith died.
Was murdered,
as we were told. Which is actually a more accurate description than what they usually say, which is martyred.
Yeah. But I think that was just because of a language barrier.
Right. If it had been the girl not from Argentina.
Yeah, she probably would have said martyred.
Anyway, so it was his house, and he also used it as his office for his business as governor and what was
Indian
it?
Manager.
Indian manager.
Which is really awful.
Yes, to manage them engines, you know. And it was it's this historical site. It's been well kept. And you and I have both been to it years ago, mm-hmm. As children, but mm-hmm. not recently. And so and certainly not after we have both left the church.
Right.
So we wanted to go and just kind of see how things are different, or how our perspective is different, and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It just so happens to be immediately after the mass resignation that we went to.
Right. It was a good time to go. We were downtown.
Yeah. And it was across the street, so, you know. I don't know. There were a few things in there that stood out to me. I mean, obviously, there's all of this, the historical background stuff, like he used this thing to teach his kids this and that kind of stuff.
Right.
But they kept bringing up, in the most positive way they possibly could manage, polygamy,
mm-hmm.
Which is a bold move on their part, because a lot of people have an knee-jerk reaction to oppose polygamy.
Mm-hmm.
But they kept trying to say that this was a necessary thing, this was a test from God, I don't know if I have enough faith to be able to do it, you know, that kind of malarkey that they were always saying.
Well, they went as far to say that they're glad they were born now so they didn't have to do polygamy.
Right, and what does that say about polygamy?
Right.
You know, it's like you think that, and they said, like, at one point, like, the other couple that was going through the tour with us made the comment, I don't think they were LDS, the man said, you know, you had to have, like, multiple houses just to keep all the women separate, otherwise they're going to be, like, backbiting and arguing all the time. And one of the sister missionaries said that they all got along, that it wasn't a problem.
Blatant lie.
Yeah.
Like, well, okay, it's probably not a lie on her part. Mm-hmm. It's ignorance on her part.
Right.
She's just spouting off what she'd been taught.
Right, and that's the other thing, is, you know, these are two girls in their early 20s. Like, they're not historians.
Like, barely 20.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah, and they don't know what this stuff is. Like, all they're doing is reciting a couple of paragraphs that they memorized, a couple of talking points for uh-huh. each room of the house. You know, and that was it. That was their script. And, you know, over and over again, like almost every room, they talk about how you can feel the spirit and you can pray to God and you can read the Book of Mormon. You can even learn another language by reading the Book of Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was all about the pitch, mm-hmm. the sales pitch.
Yeah.
You know, like they're trying to sell you something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're using this as a missionary tool. When I was a kid, I don't remember that being a part of the gig. I can't remember who it was that actually did the tour. I was too young.
It's always missionaries.
Is it always missionaries?
It's always missionaries. I want to say, though, that when we went through, I'm like, in the past when I've gone through, I want to say that they were, like, couple missionaries.
Like
I remember an older woman giving us the tour,
mm-hmm.
but I was also a lot younger.
That's
so
what I was expecting.
Mid-20s might have felt older, but I'm pretty sure they were couple missionaries.
That's what I was expecting.
Yeah.
Because that makes more sense, because they would have actually, hopefully, been, you know,
they would have had a lot more historical knowledge.
Yeah, like had some background and experience and stuff. And I think that's the case at some of the other church sites, like Nauvoo, Carthage.
The Nauvoo, Carthage, what are some of the other ones? They're all run by a couple missionaries.
The ones in Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in Salt Lake, they're trying to give a particular image. Every missionary that's on Temple Square and at all of these different sites where there are missionaries
mm-hmm.
Downtown are sister missionaries.
Yeah.
And not just sister missionaries. These are like top of the
shelf. These are young, decent-looking sister missionaries.
Exactly. They have a look.
They're not off-putting at all.
Right. They're very approachable, very personable.
I never noticed that before.
You never noticed that? Oh, I notice it every time we go.
I know they were always sister missionaries, mm-hmm. but I never noticed the looks.
Yeah.
But you are 100% right.
It's like, what was it, like last year or the year before when that one store, what was it? Abercrombie & Fitch.
Oh.
They got into big trouble because they would only hire people that looked a particular way.
Right.
They would look good uh-huh. in the clothes that they were trying to sell. Which, I mean, on one level, I understand, like, it's a company and whatever.
Right.
But on the other hand, it looks bad.
Coming you know? Out like that. Well, happened because she want, like, a girl wanted to wear a burqa or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
that's why it finally came to light.
But with the Mormons downtown, they're going for a particular look. They're mm-hmm. looking for classy, well-groomed, attractive-looking women mm. to be representatives at their headquarters.
Right.
You know. And
that's so funny.
And you see it,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah. You know, because when you talk to missionaries, maybe you'll never get them to actually admit it. When I went on my mission, there was a stigma that sister missionaries were missionaries because they couldn't get married. Okay, and so they tended to look a little more homely. They weren't the sort that you get at Temple Square,
right.
where they all look very neat and well-groomed and all mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. There were, of course, exceptions to that, but that was the stigma. That was the prejudice that we put on them.
Mm-hmm.
And now everybody is going out at the age of 18 and 19, so there's not as much opportunity for them to get married. And so you have less of that, I would imagine.
But, yeah.
But when I went on my mission, that was the case.
Yep.
And it was totally unfair.
Unfair, but to be honest, it was fairly true in a lot of cases, too. Like, I'm not married, yeah. I'm 21, so mm-hmm. I'm going to go serve a mission because maybe that'll give me brownie points.
Yeah.
I'm just so sad.
It really is.
Because then you come back and all the people you knew, all the guys you knew, are already married.
Mm-hmm.
Because they got back 2 years before you did.
Yeah, they're getting married to younger girls.
Yep.
Anyway. Anything else about the Beehive House?
Well, the tour is really boring now. We saw, like, two rooms.
Yeah. It was only the bottom floor that
and it wasn't
us.
Even the entire floor.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It was really boring. Like, I remember a lot more of that house. And they don't give you lemon drops at the end anymore. It's like you go into a little store, a little country store, and you get lemon drops or, like, a root beer barrel.
Mm-hmm. The old Pioneer candies.
Yeah. It was great. It was a nice treat after having suffered through that.
Yeah. But, I mean, it was, I don't know. I don't blame the sister missionaries for any of this because, again, they're just kids. They're ignorant. They really don't know.
Right.
You know, they're just spouting off stuff that they were told.
Mm-hmm.
But
I just hated that the other couple wasn't LDS, and so they're just taking everything at face value.
Right.
Like, everything that they said about polygamy, everything mm-hmm. they said about Brigham Young, it's like, okay, well, this has to be true because these people grew up in this religion. And,
right.
I mean, I know both of us were biting our tongues, but I had a really hard time when they started talking about polygamy.
Yeah. And what I was getting at is that they completely miss all of the bad stuff.
Yeah.
They don't talk about it. They don't bring it up. They just talk about polygamy and how it was about, you know, building a big family and supporting each other.
Oh,
and
he married
women that were older than him so that they could help with the kids and make food and clothes and that kind of thing. Like, they made it sound like it was this utopian community, mm-hmm. but it only had one man.
Yeah.
And he was in charge of everything.
Right.
You know. Yeah. Have we said how many wives and kids he has?
55 wives, 56 kids.
Which is insane.
It is insane.
It's absolutely insane.
I mean, ratio-wise, wife to kids, like, that's not a bad ratio. It's like mm-hmm. almost one kid for every wife, even though not all of them had kids. But
right.
still, 56 kids, like...
Ugh. Yeah.
Ugh. There's no way you remember all of their names, all of their birthdays.
No, especially in, like, the 1850s.
You're right.
You know, when this was going on. Like, it's... Yeah. But it's a bad environment. You know, you look at like the polygamous compounds in southern Utah, St. George and that area, and then if you watch you know, there's a few documentaries and reality TV shows, and, you know, there's Big Love on HBO, mm-hmm. Sister Wives. There's a documentary called Sons of Perdition that follows teenage boys that get kicked out of these compounds. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a dark underbelly to this mm-hmm. kind of culture.
Yeah.
And you don't hear about it, and you don't talk about it. And in the Mormon Church, you only talk about how this was a trial from God and how this built their spirituality and prepared them for heaven and right. all that kind of thing. You know, it's like you don't talk about the implications of having one man at the head of all of these families, all of these mm-hmm. households, you know, and what that creates socially.
Mm-hmm.
It's awful.
Yep.
You know, it's an abusive environment. You know.
Yeah, and they want it out.
Yeah. You know, and it raises the question, now that the Mormon Church has distanced itself so much from polygamy, if polygamy were to be legalized in the United States, what would the Mormon Church do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, would they embrace it, or would they continue to distance themselves?
Yeah. Huh. I think they would distance themselves for quite a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a feeling that they would put up another front, that they would say what they've always been saying. But then, just like with the early church, with Joseph Smith, when he started it the first time, they would do it behind closed doors. That's what I think would happen.
I still think it would take a while.
Maybe.
Just because I feel like the LDS Church very much wants to be its own governing body. Mm-hmm. And if the United States legalizes polygamy and they accept it, suddenly they're not governing themselves necessarily. Does that kind of make sense? Just like, I feel like it would have they'd have to kind of push away from the government for a while before it like works mm-hmm. itself back in.
Right. Because they like to play up this idea that they didn't stop polygamy because the United States government was taking away all of their stuff.
Right.
They stopped.
They had a revelation.
God told them to.
Yeah.
You know, so if they started up again, it's not because the United States legalized it. It's because God told us to.
Exactly.
goodness. Yeah. And it has absolutely nothing to do with the fact that the government wanted to take away their nice new temple that they just finished building that was 40 years in the making and millions of dollars.
Statehood.
Yeah. It had nothing to do with that.
Arrest their leaders.
Yeah. Anything else about the Beehive House?
Oh, I'm sure I could go on about polygamy for a while, but we can move on.
Okay. So one last thing about missionaries that I have. This was an article from the Salt Lake Tribune. Came out, today. What do you know? Yeah. It just popped up in my feed. So
that rarely happens.
I just read it. Actually, it was from yesterday. Sorry. So this is a guy named Robert Kirby, the author,
okay.
who writes about Mormon issues and especially like Mormon culture within Utah, because he's kind of a Jack Mormon, like a progressive Mormon.
Okay.
In fact, I'm fairly certain that he has officiated a gay wedding.
Oh. Interesting.
At the very least, I know he's said publicly that he would, but I'm pretty sure I read an article from him a few weeks ago saying that he actually finally did.
Huh.
Anyway, so he's a progressive Mormon. He's still a believer. He still likes to go to church, and he goes regularly. Okay, but he's not an Orthodox Mormon. He's kind of got a bit of fire.
He's going to be excommunicated if he keeps giving gay weddings.
Might, yeah.
Officiating, not giving.
Anyway, so a few weeks ago, this is something that I've been saving to talk about on the podcast. There came to light a missionary contract. Okay.
Yeah.
So what that basically means is there is this stake down in Utah County, so near BYU, where the bishops and stake presidents down there were making return missionaries sign a contract when they get home. Okay. So they get home from their 2-year mission where they've been following all the rules. They've been trying to actively convert people to Mormonism. And they get home and they have to sign this contract saying basically that they're going to continue being missionaries and dressing similarly and all that kind of stuff.
Like
and acting like missionaries and all that kind of stuff. So this guy, Kirby, wrote a piece on how this is just absolutely ridiculous. The title is Mormon Missionary Contracts Were Meant to Be Broken. So I'll just read the first little bit. It said, I came home from my mission in 1975. A few days after arrival, I had an exit interview with the stake presidency and was formally released as a full-time servant of the Lord. Note, up until that moment, I was technically still a missionary, even though I had stopped obeying the rules as soon as the plane cleared mission airspace. After being released, I was asked to report on my mission. I told the stake president that I was glad I went. I learned a lot about myself and what was important to me. They asked questions. What had my mission been like? What were the conditions of the country? How many people did I baptize? Were there any particular trials? Would I go again? Answers: tough, miserable, I didn't keep track, other missionaries, and no. The final question came from the stake president. He wanted to know what I planned to do with my life now that my mission service was over. I'm going to Galveston, Texas, and shipping out as soon as I can get a merchant marine license. Okay. Judging from the look on his face, he'd never gotten that answer before. He became concerned. What about school? What about marriage? What about church service? Nope, and no. That would all have to wait. I was going to see the world on my terms now, and nobody was going to change my mind. A few days later, I knocked on a door for a routine visit. When it opened, the spirit whispered to me, "Holy crap." I was married 5 months later.
Okay. 5 months later.
Yeah, that's Mormon culture, you know.
I am still always appalled when at that time frame, though.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
That's like 2 month courtship.
That's the libido kicking in, you know.
That's crazy.
That's the only way that you get the green light to actually act out sexually.
Yeah,
you know. Let's see. I get that my stake president was worried about my plan. There weren't many temples on boats back then, still aren't, but all he could do was offer advice, none of which I was disposed to accept. He just kind of goes on about like the interviews that go on and the kind of the expectations that returned missionaries have when they get home. You know, it's all about getting married and starting your eternal family, which, you know, on the surface sounds good. It's about, you know, family and that kind of stuff, but really what ends up happening is people get locked into the church right after their mission, so they don't really have a chance to experience the world or to really consider other options or look into church history or
grow into themselves.
Yeah, discover who they really are. You know, it's all about going through the right hoops so that the Mormon church can get them to commit to the church for good. And once they have a wife and a couple of kids, it's really, really hard to get out. I mean, we've talked about that before. You know, it's just an incredibly difficult situation once you have kids in the mix. So he talks about some of the things that some of the missionaries have to do in exit interviews. Okay, some of the more outlandish things that will sound kind of ridiculous.
Okay.
So we mentioned the contract thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So some interviews don't go that well. A friend of mine told me that his stake president had asked him to place his right hand on the Book of Mormon and covenant to attend the temple regularly.
Oh, my gosh.
Could you imagine that? Boone said he complied because it was the stake president asking, because who in that situation is going to like say no to that,
right?
You know? I mean, who was he, a mere returned missionary, to question a stake president? I've since heard rumors about things returned missionaries are pressured to do, such as date specific girls, read the Book of Mormon every year, and vow to convert at least one person wherever they worked. Okay. Again, this is all about locking people in, because the Mormon Church right now, and for the last, you know, 20 years or so, has had a really hard time getting people to stay in the church, in particular, return missionaries.
And converts.
Well, especially return missionaries who don't get married right away. Right. And if they're still single in their mid to late 20s, they there's a very high chance that they'll stop going to church regularly. And if that continues, then they'll just leave the church altogether.
You are a stereotype, sir.
I'm a statistic.
Statistic. It's practically the same thing in this case.
Yeah. Finally, he gets to talking about the contract itself, which he has a link to. It's called the Goal Planning and Personal Performance Contract for Returning Missionaries. And these are some of the things that that the missionaries are asked to do in this four-page contract. Okay. Continue to dress modestly and act like a missionary. Attend all Sunday meetings weekly. Enroll and attend Institute weekly. So Institute is a program where you basically keep studying about church stuff. It's like seminary, you know.
But you can wear your street clothes.
Yeah, because it's hip like that.
It's exactly like seminary.
Yeah,
it's you just seminary. Get to choose what class you go to.
Yeah, and there's a bunch more. Blah blah blah. Let me skip down. He gets to his favorite mandate. I will associate with and date only people who share a similar commitment to live the principles of the gospel. Again, it's all about locking people in to the church, you know. And that's what this whole contract is. It's getting them to, in a sense, formally commit themselves in a way that's even more formal than all the stuff that they've had to formally do with the temple and with the mission and seminary and stuff that they've already been doing for years, you know. And it's all just this knee-jerk reaction to keep missionaries or return missionaries from leaving the church once they get out into the real world and see, oh, wait, I don't have to be Mormon. There are other options, some of which are better. Mm-hmm. anyway, Kirby says at the end that he wouldn't sign the contract. He thinks it's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. It's just another way for them to keep track of you.
Yep.
It's like outline your career and education goals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are you looking at it right now?
Yeah. You write down commitments to your future spouse. Write down the attributes you desire most in your future spouse. My parents and siblings can expect the following from me from this point forward in my life. Like every interview this person has after he signs it is going to be referred to from this.
Uh-huh. It's just a thing that you can hold over somebody's head if they become inactive.
That would be awful.
Right? And it's incredibly specific, like the stuff in this thing.
It really is.
Elevating my life by developing positive life habits. To continue to grow spiritually in my life, I will do the following on a regular basis. And you write down things that you're going to keep doing on a regular basis to keep you believing in Mormonism.
Right. In addition to all the things that they've already written out for you.
Uh-huh. Learning respect and divine promises the Lord extends to all who earnestly seek him. I have read each of the following scriptural promises that the Lord makes to those who honor commitments. And there's just a list of scriptures and stuff. So that seems like the sort of thing that you could actually test, don't you think?
Sorry, I zoned out a little bit. Which one?
So all of the promises, the scriptural promises that the Lord makes to those who honor commitments. So this whole thing is about making commitments to God, right? Plus all of the ones that you've already made to God. And at the end of this, they give a dozen or more scriptures that talk about what the Lord's going to do to honor you if you follow what you're going to say. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the sort of thing you can test.
Right.
You know, because you can go through those motions. Uh-huh. You can do all of these things that you say that you're going to do in this piece of paper. You can do your scripture reading every day and go to the temple every week and get married right away. And then you can look at the specific things in these scriptures saying what God will do for you because you did the commitments.
Uh-huh.
And you can see whether or not he actually did them.
Right.
Seems kind of risky, don't you think?
But it's only your interpretation. So they have an out.
Yeah. I think the most damning piece of this contract is the part at the very, very end. It says, my commitment and the support of those who love me. So they have places for four different people to sign. Mm-hmm. The returning missionary, mm-hmm. your parents, your bishop, and your stake president. Like, these are the people that you're committing to, not God.
Right.
You know.
Well, is God going to show his finger to sign this?
He did for the brother of Jared in the Book of Mormon.
So. He wasn't signing things, though. He was making things shine.
Yeah. Need to put a bushel on that.
A bushel?
Anyway, just kind of ridiculous. And it's all just a knee-jerk reaction to a growing trend of inactive return missionaries. So keep it up, guys. Should we move on to one of your things?
Sure.
Good.
We'll start with this one. This is from LDS Living, and it's called Married at 19, Worth Every quote-unquote lost experience. So basically, this girl is just defending the reason why she got married at 19.
Okay. Because she really, really, really wanted to have sex for the first time.
No.
That's not it.
No.
How dare you?
So she starts off by talking about how she gets funny looks when she mentions how young she was when she got married.
Uh-huh.
That people change the topic. Mm-hmm. Or she'll hear awkward jokes about teen pregnancy statistics.
Yeah.
But the most common thing that she gets asked is why? Mm-hmm. Why would you get married so young? Because according to some, she's missing out on wonderful life experiences single people have that married people don't.
True.
She says she's told that she's missing out on opportunities to travel, chances to meet new people, the prospect of learning who I am as a person by myself, and so much more. So she doesn't think that she's missing anything, and then she lists off some reasons why.
Of course she doesn't, because she doesn't know what she's missing.
Right, exactly. She's 19. She was 19, and she doesn't know what she was missing. So her first reason that she's not missing anything is that she gets to grow with her spouse rather than alone.
You know what we need to do?
What?
We need to start advocating for Mormon Rumspringer. That's what these people need. Before they can get married at the age of 19, they need to go out
and have as much sex as they can.
Just live the life of a heathen for
a week
or two. Just Mormon Rumspringer. They can drink coffee and tea. They can say all the swears that they want, you know.
The reason they don't is because they know the majority of them wouldn't come back from that.
That's true. They can watch rated R movies.
Yeah.
You know, softcore porn, maybe.
I don't know. That's asking a lot.
Don't push it too much. Okay.
Right.
Mormon Rumspringer, no porn. Okay. Just R-rated
just sex.
Movies. Just R-rated movies and lots of sex.
At least masturbation.
Yeah.
Without feeling guilty about it.
At least that.
At least that.
At least give them that. Yeah.
Oh, wait, back to the article before this gets crazy.
Good.
Okay, so she gets to grow with her spouse. Let's see. So she thinks that because she got married before she really had a chance to develop a lifestyle of her own, she gets to grow in ways that will complement her husband. Which on some level, I guess, makes sense, but that's not convincing me that that's a good thing. I personally don't think it's a great thing.
That sounds like a one in a million kind of thing.
Well, okay, so here's my... This is, I think, the one that I have the biggest problem with. Okay. I do think that a person needs to be able to grow individually mm-hmm. before they can really settle down and be comfortable for the rest of their lives with another person.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it happens and it works the other way around, too, but I don't know.
Well, I think the issue is dependence or codependence versus independence.
Independence, right.
And it's... I think it's good advice to try to be independent because that will allow you to be codependent with somebody in a healthy way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not to the point where you have to be with somebody or have to be with a specific person.
Mm-hmm.
When you get married at such a young age and you have this, like she's describing, where you develop your personality with this person,
mm-hmm.
okay, your personality revolves around what this person expects or wants you to do, or vice versa, right? That creates a codependence before you can become independent.
Right.
And that can be problematic in the future if mm-hmm. there becomes problems in the marriage
right.
where, you know, maybe there's a divorce or something,
uh-huh.
you know. It's like...
Or suddenly that half of you that you developed to match that person is no longer relevant.
And it's no longer you.
Right.
You know. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then when you're out on your own for the first time and you're in your mid 40s or whatever, you know, you don't know how to behave. You don't know how to act. You don't know how to, you know, buy a car or, you know, I don't know. I'm just kind of reaching, but you know what I mean? It's like when you have lived your entire life codependent, it's really hard to learn independence.
Right.
You know, after that pattern's been set.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
And a good example could be your mom.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
Yeah. She kind of, well, I don't want to get into the specifics of that. But okay, one thing that I can say with my mom is that she got married when she was at BYU, okay? And she started having kids pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, she dropped out of college. She didn't finish getting her degree. And she just became a Mormon housewife. And what happens when a Mormon housewife suddenly becomes a single Mormon housewife?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have the same kind of options. Like going back to school 20, 30 years later is incredibly difficult. You basically have to start from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of like, you know, neurology and all that kind of stuff, like the pathways in your brain are already pretty much set. Like there's not a whole lot of new pathways being created the older you get. And so learning new tasks becomes harder and harder and harder the older you get.
It's
the classic saying, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. It's not entirely accurate, but there is something to it. It does become more difficult the older you get. Young kids, they can learn things super fast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, children, toddlers, like the rate at which they learn things is just mind-boggling.
Right.
When you really like look at the research that's being done and like how fast they can pick up new tasks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for older people, it becomes a lot more difficult. And if you're like, you know, a Mormon housewife who drops out of college just so you can have kids and stuff, and you depend entirely on your husband to provide for you for the rest of your life, that's not set in stone.
Right.
And you're kind of setting yourself up for failure, or at least a really, really difficult situation if something bad happens. You know, not even necessarily divorce. Like what if, you know,
an injury that prevents him from working, or he dies.
Yeah. Like, well, I have one of my mom's friends, her husband did have a health condition that prevented him from having a steady job for several years. And then it ended in a divorce. And it was extremely hard on the woman, in that situation, because in addition to having to be the breadwinner and a Mormon mom, she had 8 kids, you know, you know, I mean, it's incredibly difficult and it creates an imbalance in the relationship.
Yeah.
Where
she's molding around him.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's nothing in here about him growing in the same way that she's growing.
Right.
Which I mean, suggest something that I'm inferring from something that's lacking in this article, but still.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
but that's also very typical of the Mormon church.
Yeah. It's the gender roles that the church wants.
Yeah.
Because they want that kind of codependence because again, it makes it more difficult to leave if you're codependent.
Right. And another problem too, is that I feel like saying discovering who you are is kind of a cliche, but if you don't grow up learning kind of the like specific things that you like, things that you can, you know, cope with, things that you can handle about other people, like, and you get married really young and you start growing up with this person and you slowly start to realize that you're not as compatible as you thought. Like, I think that's also very common.
Well, I mean, there's the concept of settling down.
Yeah.
Okay. And it happens, regardless of whether or not you get married, something that people don't talk about, you know, just going from 20 to 25 or 25 to 30, there's pretty big differences, just in terms of like how much you're willing to do, how late you stay up, the kinds of activities that you want to do, how much alcohol you can drink, you know, like 20 to 25 is like the party years. And then 25 to 30, you start focusing more on career and stuff. And there are personality changes that go on in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that changes people in a way that, their spouse doesn't like.
Right.
You know,
because
some people really like being married to the partier, you know, and some people don't like what they turn into when they settle down.
Mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I don't know. There's just a lot of things to consider.
Right.
And it takes time to consider them and to really think about them. And it's really hard to do when you're 19.
Yeah, when you've been out of your house for like a year.
Yeah.
I don't know. To each their own. I mean, I would never say someone should not get married at 19.
Mm-hmm.
But really think about it and think about why you're actually getting married.
Yeah.
You know? Let's see. So another reason she gives is that she has more support in trials sooner. Which is kind of weird. So any trial she encounters now, she'll have someone to help her through them, is basically what it is she's saying.
Okay. Well, I see what she's saying, and to a certain extent, I think that that is true, but that doesn't necessarily mean that if you're not married, you can't find support.
Exactly.
You don't necessarily have to get support from a spouse. You can get it from
other family members.
A boyfriend or girlfriend.
Yeah.
You know, family members, parents.
Mm-hmm. What happens when the trial is your spouse?
Yeah.
There's always going to be a moment when your spouse is a trial.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. It's, anyway.
Yeah. She continues by saying that she's learning more about selflessness. Because for her marriage to work, she has to put her spouse first, even before her own desires.
But what does that have to do with being married at 19? You just learn
it means earlier. That she's starting earlier because okay. She says that it's hard for young people to do something like that. Which...
Okay.
On a lot of levels, she's right. It is hard for a younger person to put someone else before them because sure. They are still growing into themselves.
Yeah. But again, that just feeds into the idea that she's becoming codependent.
Yeah, and she's doing things to satisfy her partner before she thinks about what would be satisfying for her.
Yeah. Which, I mean, that's not even a healthy outlook.
No, it's not, but it's very Mormon.
It is very Mormon.
It is so Mormon.
Yeah, because again, it sounds good on the surface. It's a deepity.
Yeah,
you know,
totally. So the one of the last ones she gives is married couples are more financially stable, are happier, and live longer. And then she provides a couple of links, none of which are very solid.
Mm-hmm.
More studies are being done on the differences between happiness in marriage versus happiness in cohabitated couples versus people who are single.
Right.
And on some levels, married people tend to be a little more happy. But I think what some of the articles were getting at was that it kind of depends on the personality of the people that are married. Like some people yeah. just thrive more when they're independent. Yeah. Some people thrive more when they're attached to someone else.
Yeah.
So it's very like individualized. It depends on who you are as a person. So I don't think these articles mm-hmm. really support what she's saying.
But
especially because they don't give statistics.
She thinks they do though.
Right.
So that's what's important.
Right. Yeah. I won't really go into them because they're not very informative.
Okay.
But the last reason she gives is that she still gets to pursue her dreams even if those dreams have changed. So they're not the same dreams that she had growing up. Like okay. Before she starts in on all this, she gives a little background and says that, you know, she planned on going on a mission, coming mm-hmm. home from a mission, moving into like a studio apartment in the city and buying a Great Dane to live with her.
That is mighty specific.
Right? And now that she's married, she doesn't get to do any of that. But, you know, now she's thinking about moving to Europe with her husband for a few years. So the dream is different, but it's still something she can accomplish. But I wonder how much thought she's put into that.
Right.
Because I would love to do that. But it's really expensive for two people to travel to another country and just settle down and live there for a few years.
Yeah. Like, what are you going to do for work?
Yeah, getting a work visa for more than like 6 months at a time, especially right now, is really hard. And there's the consideration of another language you're going to have to learn depending right. on where you go. Like,
what happens if you have a kid?
What happens? Yeah, exactly. What happens if you have a child? So, I mean, I understand why she writes it, but I don't think... that she has that much of a leg to stand on because right. she got married so young. Like, right. of course she has to defend that position.
Well, the thing that that troubles me the most about this isn't so much that she's defending why she made her decision. The part that really bothers me is that Mormons are coming from a place where they think that other people should make the same decision. Mm-hmm. It's fine for somebody to make the decision for themselves.
Right.
If that's what she really wants to do, fine. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't do it. It's not the decision I would make. It's not the decision I did make.
Nope. For either one of us.
Yeah. But it's fine for her to do it if that's what she really wants to do. Mm-hmm. But Mormons take it a step further and try to make people feel bad for not doing that. Mm-hmm. They try to, like, how many times have you heard this over the pulpit? That you should get married early and don't let a career stop you from having kids. Mm-hmm. You know, don't worry about finishing school before you start having kids or getting married.
Right.
You know, those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. It's like they want you to dive headfirst into the whole situation. Mm-hmm. You know. And just let God take the wheel.
Right, because you become codependent on the spouse, mm-hmm. and, quote-unquote, God.
And
the church.
Yeah. You become dependent on the church, because the church becomes your social life.
Exactly.
It becomes your connections, mm-hmm. to various things, sometimes professionally. Mm-hmm. You know, it's how you raise your kid. It's how you get babysitters. You know, it's how you get the free casseroles when you have birth. You know, give birth, like, you know, that first week, you know?
When you have birth.
That was more of a brain fart than a Freudian slip.
I know. Just
but
funny.
But you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they want to hook them.
Yeah.
You know?
Everything revolves around the church.
And the church paints the picture that all people are the same, or at least they're all close enough to being the same, that the same formula will work for everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't make your own decision. You can't have an independent thought.
Right.
You can't come at it from a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
like, you have to accept what they say.
Yep.
And that's what she's advocating.
Mm-hmm.
She's just not saying it.
Right.
She's defending the position of getting married early because that's the decision that she made. But what it really means is that that's the decision that she accepted from the church.
Mm-hmm.
That's what she's defending.
Right. Right. At the end of almost all of her reason, she says, so why shouldn't I get married so I can experience these things sooner? You know,
yeah.
Implying, why wouldn't you get married early so you can experience these blessings sooner?
She's supporting the church's point of view. As much as she's supporting her own decision.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Probably more so.
Right.
Anyway. Anything else?
On that one? No.
Yeah. No. Okay. I have one more thing. You have one more thing, right?
I have two more things.
Two more things?
I can talk about the next thing that kind of ties in with that I just talked about.
Go ahead.
Okay. So this is an article in the Deseret News, but it's from a conference that was in Salt Lake City like a week or so ago, August 7th.
Okay.
So it was a singles conference, a mid-singles conference.
Oh, gosh. What's the age range for mid-singles? Do they give
it? My guess is post-missionary age.
Well, that would be young singles.
So it's probably 25 to 30.
Okay.
I don't know. They don't give an age range.
Okay.
But I would consider myself, if I was unmarried, to be a mid-single. So 25 to 30.
Okay. Not cream of the crop, but, you know, still eligible. Sorry, I'm just trying to use Mormon terms.
Okay. So the two main speakers at this conference was Dallin Oaks and his wife,
so Kristen Oaks. Dallin Oaks is an apostle.
Yes.
In the church.
One of the 12 apostles.
Yeah.
And he comes up a lot in the news because he's a lawyer and he's involved in a lot of anti-LGBT things.
Right. He's a peach.
Yes.
He's a real peach.
The more I read about him, the less I like him. Just say that.
He's a very dried peach.
Yeah. He's always been really dry.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway. So let's see. He talks. So this conference is basically to make people in their mid to late 20s feel better about being single.
Okay.
But they have an interesting way of saying
words,
that.
In other words, he's trying to undo some of the damage that he's caused.
Yeah, but they don't do a very good job of that. That's why I wanted to talk about this, basically.
Okay.
So they start off the conference by saying, you are loved and you are important. But from this article, they don't ever go into saying, like, how they are important to the fabric of the LDS church, basically.
Right. Like, what is their place within their little society?
Right. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to read some of just what he said in general.
Okay.
So this is from Oaks. As I have continued my lifelong interest in singles, having been raised from childhood by a single mother, I have been interested in the increasing numbers of singles in the United States and in the church. Mm-hmm.
That first line is incredibly creepy.
Yeah, his lifelong interest in singles. Totally.
That is so creepy sounding.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand what he's saying, mm-hmm. but out of context, that could be very, very different.
Right. So he goes on to say, singles are such an important part of the church. They are an important part of the country, too. But he doesn't say why.
Yeah, it's implied.
Yes. So they, quote, draw from some of their own experiences and shared some counsel that has helped them during various times in their own lives.
Mm-hmm.
So his current wife is his second wife.
Yeah.
And they got married when she was in her mid-50s, which is the first time that she was married. So she was single for
until
like
her 50s.
50 years of her life.
Wow.
Yeah. So I'm just going to read this, what he says again, because I think it's kind of funny. So he says, Kristen and I, she more than I, are former singles ourselves. I just feel like some of the things he says are incredibly condescending, but he sugarcoats it enough that it's like people in the church just don't see it.
Yeah.
But like, if you had ever said something like that to me, like she was single into her mid 20s, you know, she more than I, I'd be like, excuse me. I don't know. So she was single into her mid-50s until we were married. I was single between the death of my first wife and my meeting Kristen 2 years later. So he draws on his single experience of 2 years.
Right. As an apostle.
As an apostle of the church, yeah. Who's already, one, experienced sex, has already had children, already has an established career, has an established place in the church.
Yep.
For 2 years, he was single. What a hardship.
It's so hard. It's so hard.
So hard.
You know what would be really refreshing is if he talked about his experience during those 2 years with his porn addiction. Could you imagine a candid conversation with Elder Oaks about him being addicted to porn those 2 years he was single?
No. He's too dry to ever admit to having sinned. To any specific sin.
Yeah.
So they go on to say, you know, to mention that there are capable, beautiful LDS women and capable, hardworking, and kind LDS men who are trapped by fear and doubt.
Especially doubt.
Yep. Yeah. They're shackled by fear to marry. And then he goes on to say that it's when men and women become team players that they can succeed together.
Yay, codependency.
Interdependence is the kind of life the Lord desires for us. Okay.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sneaky, sir.
Exactly. Interdependence sounds a lot better than codependence.
It is better because that means you have two independent people who are working together.
Right.
That's not what happens when you get married at 19.
No. No.
It's just not.
No. For these mid-singles, you can probably argue that, yeah, you'll probably have a more of an interdependent relationship earlier on.
Yeah.
But still.
Okay.
So he warned against being influenced by the wrong worldly messages. He said, quote, we have to be careful when we are single and we don't have a spouse to steady us, that we are not unduly influenced by worldly messages. For example, the world seeks and honors the accumulation of money, property, car, home, travel, graduation before marriage, etc., etc. Jesus said, seek ye first the kingdom of God and all these things shall be added unto you. Now keep in mind, he started this off by saying, you're loved and you have a place in this church.
Right.
But for me, like if I was sitting in this conference, I would not be getting that message.
Right. Because they like to make premises or not premises. They like to make assertions without supplying real support for it.
Right.
You know,
and in this, he's implying that if you're single, you have a tendency to make more bad decisions than if you had a spouse who would be able to counteract that. Poor decision making.
Right.
Which is not true of most people.
That doesn't
especially
sound like,
a lot of young people in the LDS church.
It doesn't sound like he's advocating for being single.
No. And throughout the rest of this, they're definitely not.
See, your place in our culture is to be a red flag for everybody so that they know what not to do.
Okay, so Elder Oaks warned listeners of the enslavement and bondage that come from addictions, a harmful substance, pornography, or philosophies that detract from righteous living, and encouraged them to use their time wisely. What do you think those are? He can't give specifics. He can't give specifics because giving specifics gives real ideas to these poor, vulnerable singles.
Right. Yeah, it's the oracle dilemma, where an oracle will give very vague advice so that you can interpret it however you need to in order to do something good.
Right.
But if nothing good comes from it, they can say, "Oh, well, you just didn't understand what I said."
Mm-hmm.
That's what he's doing.
Yep.
You know.
Let's see. So Sister Oaks spoke, and she said, "We are torn between a world that teaches openly," and I hate this. I really don't like this. "So we're torn between a world that teaches openly that motherhood, children, marriage, and family are not important."
No, they don't.
Exactly. "Many of us who most value family time must still work to ensure that there is food on the table and a roof over our heads." So it's just a blatant lie.
Yeah.
The world is not teaching that motherhood isn't important. It's not teaching that you shouldn't have children. It's just saying that there are other ways to do it.
There are other things that are also important.
Yeah. And that the traditional way is not the only way, nor is it necessarily the best way.
Well, it goes back to the thing we were talking about before. Mm-hmm. The Mormon Church wants everybody to fall into the same category. They want everybody to follow the same formula.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that everybody who follows this formula will have the same outcome. They will be successful.
Right.
Okay. And the world is saying, you can make your own decisions.
Yeah.
That's the difference.
Yeah.
And they
if you want to be a mother, be a mother. But if you don't want to be a mother married to someone else, then don't be, you know, be a single mother. If you can do it, do it.
Yeah. The world is saying you have options.
Exactly.
And the church is saying, no, you don't.
No, you have one option.
Yeah. If you want to have real lasting success and happiness.
Yeah, exactly. You have to be married to the person of the opposite sex and have children, as many as you can.
Yeah. Well, okay, so here is one thing that was said by Kate Kelly in her talk yesterday. She realized how ridiculous it is that when she was on her mission at the age of 21, talking to people with real, difficult situations, like financial troubles and marital problems and stuff, her answer to all of it, every single time, is read the Book of Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
That's where your answer is.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what the hell does she know?
Yeah. Yep.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So she goes on and says, "Single sisters are torn between a world and a job and a family they don't have yet. And so I say to you, respect your feelings, sisters. They are God-given. I testify these yearnings are divine. Embrace them and learn to balance them and thank God for them. They are a gift to remind us of who we are, celestial beings in a telestial situation. This is not our eternal home." So the problem with this, I feel like, is that they're assuming that each single sister in that crowd has this desire to be a mother and to be married, which isn't necessarily true.
But if you were to ask them, they would say it.
Yeah. But they're only saying that because they think that's the only option. They think there's something wrong with them if they don't feel that way.
Yep.
I thought there was something wrong with me, and I'm sure my sister, Missy, felt the same way. You know?
Yeah.
It's like, we didn't have that desire. I didn't want to be married to a man because I felt like I would have no individuality.
Yeah.
I could see myself with kids, but I could not see myself with a spouse for a long time. And I had wanted to have nothing to do with any of those lessons about getting married.
Yeah.
You know, but they don't address this to people like that. It's like come out and say, if you don't want to get married, you still have a place. You can still go on to be a member in the General Relief Society or, you're still important.
The next Sherry Dew.
Right. They don't mention people like that. It's all revolving around your goal is still to get married. If you're single now, that's okay, but you still need to be married.
Yep. The end game is to be married.
Exactly.
Even if it happens in the next life. Does he ever bring that up?
They don't talk about it happening in the next life.
Because that's something that I remember hearing all the time. If you don't get married in this life, at least for the sister missionary, or for the sisters in the congregation, then you'll get the opportunity in heaven, which translates into you'll get paired up with a man who's already married, probably, and be in a polygamous relationship.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Have fun with that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, that's basically the whole article. It's just kind of infuriating, especially because I have another sister that's in this situation, who's still being taught the exact same thing. It's okay that you're single, but this still needs to be the goal. Mm-hmm. And it is her goal. It has been her goal since we were very young. Yeah. She has been the only child, I feel like, in our family that's had this goal of being married, of having children.
Yeah.
And she's the one that has encountered the most obstacles with it.
Yeah.
And
And you
know, and she's doing everything she's supposed to.
Right. And she's, I mean, she's a good Mormon girl.
Mm-hmm.
She does what she's supposed to in the eyes of the church.
Yeah.
So the fact that she hasn't had this happen for her yet, what does that do to her self-esteem?
Exactly. Especially when she has an apostate sister who got married.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to an apostate.
To an apostate.
Yeah.
You know? I don't know.
Oh, yes. Okay.
So yeah, that's all I have on that.
Okay. So the last thing that I have, this was an article that was also from the Salt Lake Tribune. Actually, I don't want to read the article itself. Basically, the main point of the article is that in Mormonism, there's this concept of celestial kingdom, terrestrial kingdom, and the telestial kingdom, all being mm-hmm. various levels within heaven. Okay, so celestial is the best of the best. Terrestrial is, you know, pretty okay, not too bad, you know, just average people. And then the telestial kingdom is for apostates and reprobates and perverts and murderers and, you know, that kind of
stuff. But it'll still be as nice as Earth.
But it'll be at least as nice as Earth. Okay. And what this does, and this is what the article points out, is this creates a lot of strife within Mormon units, family units, mm-hmm. on the Earth right now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it's supposed to be this thing that you look forward to. You can have your eternal family in the celestial kingdom and be together forever and all that kind of stuff, which is, you know,
don't try to work out the logistics.
It sounds nice. Okay. And that's what's important to the Mormons, is that right. It sounds nice.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But when you have somebody such as myself or you who leaves the Mormon church and that option of going into the celestial kingdom with your eternal family forever and ever, it's taken off the table, that can create a lot of tension between relationships with the children and their parents,
mm-hmm.
Or between children, you know, mm-hmm. And you know, it's like one of the first things that my mom did when she found out that I stopped going to church and when I told her I was an atheist, she cried mm-hmm. and said that she had failed me as a mother, and that she was so sad that she wouldn't have her little Matthew in heaven anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she was torn to pieces over this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it's still, a point of it's just, it's a sore spot
mm-hmm.
between us. Okay. And, we don't really talk about it openly. We avoid the elephant in the room because Mormons
are really good at that.
They love to keep their elephants nice and prominent, but you know, mm-hmm. behind a tree, you know, anyway,
I just had an image.
You're welcome. anyway, so that's the point of the article. It's by a guy named John Ogden, titled Belief in Sad Heaven Hurts Relationships in Era of Mormon Doubt. So lots of people are leaving the Mormon church, so this is becoming a bigger and bigger issue. It's a point of contention and all that kind of stuff. But it turned into an interesting conversation on my Facebook feed. Where people were talking about how they interact with people who have left the church, or if they've left the church, how they interact with people who've stayed in the church. And
mm-hmm.
it's kind of this, you know, give and take thing. And one of my friends from my Seattle ward growing up left a pretty long comment about her experience, because she's in a mixed faith marriage.
Okay.
She's kind of a progressive Mormon, and her husband isn't a believer, but I think he still goes to church just for social reasons and stuff like
okay.
that. But like, she has other like family members and friends who've left the church. And this is just a very tender spot for her. Okay. So she wrote what I consider a very well put, response to this idea of sad heaven and, you know, communicating between believers and non-believers and how you can actually keep the relationship going and that kind of thing. So I thought I'd just read it, because again, I think it's put really well. She says, I've been on both sides of the faith transition, and I can vouch for how painful it is for everyone. Excruciating. That being said, there are a couple of things that are worth considering when dealing with your own family members. And I write this more as a general comment for others who may read this thread than necessarily to address your particular circumstances. So this is in response to somebody who basically said that they believe in the church, and in their experience, people who leave the church sever ties with them rather than the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, when someone is going through a transition, they are usually going through the grief process, which is something that we talked about a few episodes ago, a number of episodes ago. It's really, really painful to have doubts, and that pain, as is common in grief, will often manifest as anger. For the more believing family member, that is going to feel like a toxic conversation that you can't be a part of, and that's fair. But realize that their inability to keep it in is because they need someone safe to listen to as they unload their feelings. If you can't be that person, fine. But it's not necessarily true that you were willing to meet them halfway and they just refused to show respect, which is something that the person kind of implied in their first comment. It may be more like it's a lot. There's a lot of pain and you both need space for a while. Secondly, even when there isn't anger, maybe there may be some desperation. The new information or experiences are very upsetting, and as someone feels they're tumbling off a faith cliff, all of the troubling things will probably spill out as they look for comfort, sense, and validation for their feelings. As before, if you can't be the person to give it, it's okay. But it doesn't mean they're completely inconsiderate either. Finally, losing your faith is like losing your worldview and identity, which is very, very true. It is a very vulnerable position. Someone going through that is going to feel threatened, just as the sad heaven believers feel threatened. That means that if you hide your sadness or disapproval, it's unlikely that they won't feel it, know it, or even anticipate it. That part, I think, is really important.
Read that again.
That means that even if you hide your sadness or disapproval, it's unlikely they won't feel it, know it, or even anticipate it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So even though you feel like you're hiding your disapproval, like, for instance, my own mother hides her disapproval of me.
Or my parents.
Yeah. You know it's there.
Mm-hmm.
You know it's there from the things that they say and the things that they don't say.
Mm-hmm. Because even when they're not directed at you.
Yeah. And we could give countless examples of that.
Yeah, and we've given some examples.
Yeah. Going on. They already know, because it's what they believed just a while ago. They know they're a disappointment, and if they're not, you'll have to prove it to them. Meaning, if you really believe that they're not a disappointment in your eyes, you need to show it to them.
Right.
Because it's basically the de facto position that if you leave the religion, people who stay in the religion are going to be disappointed in you.
Mm-hmm.
My husband's faith crisis was the most painful period in both of our lives. We have been through a lot, and it all pales in comparison to that hellfest period. It took a lot of prayer for me to understand and survive that period. And when I was pleading in prayer to know what to do, when I felt so hurt and betrayed, the answer was repeatedly, just love him more. That's one of the reasons why it's so hard for people to leave the Mormon Church once they've been married and have kids. It tears the relationship.
Yeah.
Potentially.
Mm-hmm.
And in almost every case that I've ever heard, it does. You know. We were both scared and felt insecure. So to anyone reading this whose family member or friend is going through a faith transition, there is nothing about it that's fair. It will stretch everyone. And you may have to go beyond what you thought you were capable of to reach out to them. Taking some space and time for yourself is fine. But acknowledge that what you're doing, but acknowledge that's what you're doing, and don't place all the blame and responsibility on them to fix things. Anyway, faith transitions are tough.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anything to add to that?
No, that was a good comment.
Yeah. Yeah, anyway.
Not much I can add to that. You know?
Yeah, and I think a lot of people just, I mean, a faith crisis is really difficult. It's a new thing for a lot of people. They don't have a lot of experience with it. They don't know how to react to it. There's a lot of pain and hurt on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you just need space.
Mm-hmm.
And it may come across as being, avoiding or whatever, or lashing out or anger.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that anybody is at fault.
Right.
Least of all, the people going through the faith crisis,
mm-hmm.
you know. Anyway, did you have anything else?
I had one thing, but it doesn't connect to any of that we just talked about.
Do you want to share it or save it for later?
I can share it real quick.
Okay.
I won't bring it up later. Okay. It was just, there was a Fair Mormon conference or something.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the speakers talked about swords in the Book of Mormon. Basically, his conclusion was that steel swords aren't mentioned past like a certain time in the Book of Mormon to like Jerem or something like that. And so any sword after that is a wooden sword. So he thinks that wooden swords were used, not steel swords. And that if there were steel swords around, they would have been few and far between. They would have been the exception, not the rule. And they would have been like Valyrian steel in Game of Thrones, you know.
Okay.
Where it elevates your status, so, but not everyone has one.
So his argument then is that the Jaredites and the early Nephites had the technology to create steel swords.
And lost it. He does say that.
Lost it.
Yes.
They lost the ability.
Yes.
Okay, if that's the case, there would still be evidence. There would still be steel swords. There would still be the furnaces that they would have used to make them.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't get them out of anything.
No, and I feel like there would still be evidence of wooden swords, too.
Yeah. Like, it's.
I mean, they've found wooden artifacts from Indians and stuff. Like, mm-hmm. They would have found wooden swords.
Yeah, he's grasping at straws.
Yeah, totally.
Like, he has no reason to say that. No. The only reason he's saying that, again, is because of his religious belief and he mm-hmm. has to defend it.
Right.
He has no evidence.
Yeah. But I thought it was entertaining. Wooden swords.
And it should be noted, since we've been talking about missionary work and faith crises and all that, this is the kind of stuff that is very off-putting for a lot of believers because mm-hmm. they expect there to be clear-cut, well-thought-out, supported by evidence responses to these questions mm-hmm. about anachronisms in the Book of Mormon and mm-hmm. the historicity and all that. And when they come across answers like this from Mormon apologists, they think, holy crap, this is all just a sham. Like this doesn't help. This doesn't
right.
bolster faith. This right. is just grasping at straws. This is just trying to find any rationalization to support yeah. their beliefs.
Yeah, and why wouldn't wooden swords have been mentioned at some point?
Right. Yeah, that's the other thing. It's like, yeah. it's not just the anachronisms of things that are put in that shouldn't be there. There's a lot of things that should be there that aren't.
Yeah, and the church has taught that they were steel swords. I mean, all of the pictures you see in primary and stuff, they all have steel swords.
Yep. Yep.
And steel armor.
Yeah.
They are knights.
Yeah, and for him to say that it was the exception and not the rule, I mean, just read the account at the end of the Book of Ether.
Right.
With the Jaredites killing each other off. 2 million people died in that last battle. And they all had, at least the way that it reads, it suggests that they all had steel swords and steel-plated armor.
Uh-huh.
Where are they?
Yeah.
Where are they?
At least the bodies.
Mm-hmm.
There should be lots of bones.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought insane. It was ridiculous.
It's insane.
Yeah. Okay. I wanted to share it.
Well, I think that's our show.
Thanks for listening.
If you would like to contact us, you can email us at skepticsquarepodcast@gmail.com. And you can check out the show's blog at www.skepticsquarepodcast.blogspot.com. And we'll catch you next time at the Skeptic Square Podcast.
Smooth.
Rammsprenger.